For the past 8 months, our independent investigators have been engaged in an exhaustive review of the allegations. They've conducted more than 250 interviews with more than 150 people, including current and former university administrators, athletic officials, students, and faculty. As additional allegations were uncovered in the course of the investigation, their veracity was pursued and they are included in the report. In all, investigators reviewed more than 50,000 documents, including internal memos, letters, email accounts, and financial records. The final report, in my judgment, is comprehensive, it's thorough, it's fair. The findings compel the disturbing conclusion. Between 1993 and 1998, there was systematic, widespread academic misconduct in the men's basketball program. In addition, there were cash payments to student athletes, and there was an effort to interfere with the investigation by Coach Haskins. The report also makes clear that in addition to the individual violations involving cheating and money paid to student athletes, the NCAA will find that we violated its standards for institutional control. Athletic and central administrators failed to adequately manage the basketball program. It became an isolated fiefdom, allowed to operate virtually unchecked. While the corruption was narrowly centered in men's basketball, the deference to the wishes of Coach Haskins extended to high ranks of the university's administration. Because of this loss of control, the fraud continued unchecked for years. The scope and duration of this misconduct make it one of the most serious academic fraud cases ever reported to the NCAA. These are serious and troubling findings. This kind of fraud strikes at the heart of our most valuable and precious resource, the university's academic integrity. What this university is about, first and foremost, is education. Academic misconduct, cheating, fraud, is simply unacceptable at this university. Before presenting the details of the action plan, let me first say to the people of the great state of Minnesota that I am deeply sorry. I apologize for what has happened and what did not happen to prevent this activity. I regret that we brought shame and embarrassment upon the university for which you've demonstrated such loyalty. I hope that you will accept this heartfelt apology and join with us as we begin rebuilding trust. For the past week, I've anguished over the decisions I needed to make in response to this investigation. While the report makes very clear that misconduct occurred, it does not articulate an equally clear course of action. In considering alternative actions, I reviewed thoroughly the report, portions of the testimony, and many of the exhibits. I took into account both the remedial actions we've already taken and the sanctions that may be imposed on us by the NCAA. And frankly, I called upon my 25-plus years as a lawyer and a law school teacher. That training and experience requires me to ground my decisions in the evidence before me as contained in that report. In addition, I adhere to four guiding principles. We must take action that restores the confidence of the people of Minnesota in the academic integrity of the university. We must accept responsibility and hold ourselves accountable. Our actions must be designed to prevent the circumstances that led to the very serious ethical and rule violations that have occurred. We must be fair to the individual people involved, administrators, faculty members, and students, and we must respond aggressively to the significant violations of Board of Regents policy and NCAA rules. Let me also remind you that the actions I take today are in addition to those we've already taken. When we became aware of the allegations of academic misconduct, we acted quickly to deal with the immediate issue, the eligibility of four of our players who were in Seattle, and then we launched this independent investigation. All of the individuals, including coaches, staff, and students, who were directly involved in the misconduct, all of those directly involved in the misconduct are no longer at the University of Minnesota. We completed a report on allegations of interference into sexual misconduct investigations. As a result, significant policy changes are being implemented. We've imposed a ban on postseason play and placed ourselves on NCAA probation. It is also important to remember that the steps I announced today are not the last consequences the university faces. This report finds that during the last five seasons, the men's basketball team competed with one or more ineligible players because they received improper academic assistance, and thus they were not eligible to participate in the NCAA games in which they did participate. As a consequence, the university may be required by the NCAA to forfeit some games won during that period and to repay some revenues and to recover some revenues for participating in NCAA postseason events. With the principles I've articulated in mind, I'm taking the following steps. First, I'm implementing significant structural changes to reduce the inherent natural conflicts and create a rigorous system of checks and balances. Management of intercollegiate athletic programs will be assigned to the President's Chief of Staff beginning on December 1st. Over the next several months, I will confer with the regents, the faculty, and others on the issue of converting the Chief of Staff's position into an office of the Vice President for Administration with a recommendation to the Board of Regents likely in February. The Athletic Academic Counseling Office will be reassigned to the Office of the Executive Vice President and Provost effective December 1st. The NCAA Big Ten Athletic Compliance Function will be reassigned to the Office of the General Counsel effective December 1st. I'm also taking other steps to create a stronger system of oversight of intercollegiate athletics. The procedures announced in July restricting the role of athletics personnel and in the investigation and resolution of sexual assault or misconduct will remain in place pending consultation with the provost, student groups, faculty, and others about the need for permanent changes in the handling of such claims. The provost and the faculty will also consider any needed changes in faculty oversight of intercollegiate athletics. The faculty consultative committee has already adopted a resolution addressing many of these issues. In consultation with the provost and the consultative committee, I will be reviewing the faculty representation to the NCAA. Issues of faculty complicity or misconduct identified by the report will be addressed in the collegiate units consistent with university procedures and the tenure code. And any potential disciplinary actions against students or former students will be referred for consideration by the dean and faculty of the individual colleges involved. I also want to announce that I today have accepted the resignations of Dr. McKinley Boston and Dr. Mark Deanhart. A search will commence immediately for a new Vice President of Student Development to replace Dr. Boston. Until the end of his contract on June 30, 2000, Dr. Boston will retain responsibility for student development functions. Dr. Deanhart's resignation is effective December 6th. I will appoint an interim men's athletic director within the next few weeks. A search for a permanent athletics director will commence immediately. The contracts of the associate men's athletic director and the compliance officer will not be renewed. These have been tough, very tough decisions, and I have not come to them lightly. But upon review of the report, I felt that I had to make changes in both the structure and in the personnel. Individuals entrusted with leadership responsibilities in this institution are held accountable for managing people and programs, to play by the rules, and to maintain the values of this great university, again, first among them, academic integrity. While nothing in the report, nothing demonstrates that either Dr. Boston or Dr. Deanhart knew of the cheating, the facts show that they had strong reason to be suspicious of the operation of the basketball counseling program. Plenty of warning signs were sent. Despite singles of the irregularities, no adequate investigation was ever launched during this period. Although the circumstances may have been difficult, given the power culture surrounding Clem Haskins, I believe both Dr. Deanhart and Dr. Boston missed opportunities to act aggressively, particularly after I became president in July 1997. I want and expect and demand proactive, open management with a heavy dose of personal responsibility. I believe that where there is delegation, there must also be strict accountability. We failed to provide institutional oversight, I believe in part, because the management of men's athletics and the Office of Student Development and Athletics did not adhere to these priorities. Therefore, I have concluded that based upon the findings of the report, new leadership for student development and men's athletics is warranted and appropriate. Well, I've determined that the evidence warrants personnel changes, and I accepted their resignations. I want to say a few words about McKinley Boston and Mark Deanhart. I know both Dr. Boston and Dr. Deanhart to be honorable men with integrity. This investigation reveals nothing that makes me question that knowledge. And my actions today represent no questioning of that integrity. I also want to make it clear, very clear, that our probe into allegations of interference in sexual misconduct investigations found no instance whatsoever of interference with such investigations by Dr. Deanhart, Dr. Boston, or anyone else, and no inappropriate actions by university police. Both Dr. Deanhart and Dr. Boston have made significant contributions to the university. Dr. Deanhart's tenure as athletics director has been notable for its competitive programs, the high caliber of coaches he's hired, and the financial management of the department. I also want to note Dr. Boston's strong commitment to improving access to the university for disadvantaged students and students of color. He has worked tirelessly to build better linkages between the university and the broader community, and for that we are all grateful. The media has played a vital role, true to their fundamental place under the First Amendment, in investigating and revealing the corruption in the basketball program. But I found the vilification of these individuals by some in the media both repugnant and unjustified. These are honorable people who made some mistakes. Let me also say that I know that these findings will cause some to second-guess my decision to buy out Coach Haskins' contract and pursue leadership, new leadership for the men's basketball program. In retrospect, however, I believe I made the right decision because it was absolutely critical to get new leadership of the program in place to allow the season to start unencumbered by these allegations. It was also the right decision given the information I had at the time. In fact, investigators only received new information regarding Clem Haskins within the past few weeks, the end of October. Finally, the report is clear that the misconduct was primarily confined to the men's basketball program. The university has nearly 700 talented and committed student athletes. They have an average GPA and graduation rate higher than the rest of the student body. It would be an injustice to let this scandal taint perceptions of our student athletes who've weathered this very difficult time with poise and dedication. Indeed, and I think this is the genuine truth, the ultimate victims of this misconduct are the student athletes who we promised to educate. We failed those students in the most basic ways, and for that, I again say that we're deeply sorry. I feel confident that our new leadership team and this new structure, combined with changes in faculty oversight being considered by the Faculty Consultative Committee, will allow us to put this issue behind us and assure the people of Minnesota that the University of Minnesota is back on track. While I believe these are the right steps and they will improve oversight and restore confidence, structural and personnel changes alone do not constitute a guarantee. We must maintain constant vigilance, and the best way to do that is through full public disclosure. My commitment today to the people of Minnesota is that by July 1st, 2000, and again in 1 year, I will provide a report on our progress. I'm grateful for the support I have received from the Board of Regents and from the public during this difficult period. I said when I became president of this great university that I would keep my compact with the people of Minnesota, that I would meet their generosity with my commitment to excellence, honesty, and integrity in education. The actions I recommend today are part of that commitment. That concludes my statement, and now I'm pleased to turn the podium over to Regent Patricia Spence, the Chair of the Board of Regents.
Thank you, Mark. Good afternoon. As the President said, I'm Patricia Spence, Chair of the Board of Regents, and before I begin my remarks, I would like to acknowledge my colleagues on the board who are present in the front row this afternoon, the Vice Chair, Regent Maureen Reed, Regent Dallas Bonsack, former Board Chair, Regent William Hogan, Regent David Metzen, and Regent Jessica Phillips, and I thank you for being here. First, on behalf of the board, I want to affirm our support for the actions presented by President Udoff. We share the core values guiding his decisions, academic integrity and fairness. And we believe that this investigation was both thorough and fair. This is a very sad day. The cheating and the breakdown in institutional controls in men's basketball have brought dishonor to our great university. For this, the board also apologizes to the citizens of Minnesota. It is our hope that today we can begin the process of healing and restoring the public's confidence and trust. Board of Regents policy in this area is very clear. Academics come first. And there are to be separate reporting lines for athletes and for academic counseling. What we have learned in this investigation is that these policies were not always followed in men's basketball. What we have also learned is that even with the right procedures in place, people can choose to violate them. As an entire university community, we must recommit to upholding the highest standards of integrity and honesty. No one can look the other way. The president's announced actions demonstrate the values of this institution and this president. The regents respect President Udoff for his strong leadership, and we totally support him. These have been very difficult and painful decisions based on his best judgments to ensure our institutional integrity. As regents, we take our role as stewards of public resources very seriously, and we are intimately aware that we are accountable to the citizens and the people of Minnesota. We want all citizens to understand that the entire cost associated with this investigation will be borne by the men's athletic department, not by tax dollars. We hope that the actions taken today do not overshadow the positive accomplishments of the great majority of students and staff in men's athletics. The board wants to recognize the dedicated student athletes who study and compete, successfully maintaining their academic and their athletic lives. They bring great honor to the University of Minnesota. And finally, the board asks all of you, the faculty, the staff, the students, and the citizens of Minnesota, for your support. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tanya Brown, Chief of Staff for President Udoff. As many of you know, I've spent a great deal of the last 6 months coordinating this investigation. And while I regret the circumstances that have brought us to this juncture, I am committed to working with President Udoff and the Board of Regents to provide new leadership to the athletic departments. In my new role, my first priority will be to establish a rigorous system of institutional oversight to prevent misconduct of this sort from happening again. I look forward to working with the provost, faculty leadership, students, and the athletic administration to develop strategies to accomplish this goal. I am also committed to better integrating athletics with the greater university community. The President and I believe that too often and for too long, athletics has operated in isolation. Intercollegiate athletics must support and enhance the mission of the university, not the other way around. Next, the structural changes that the President announced with respect to what is currently designated as the Office for Student Development and Athletics will take time to implement. In addition to the personnel changes that have been mentioned today, we will be conducting a thorough review of personnel, of structures, and by January 31, I am committed to making recommendations to President Udoff if any additional restructuring is necessary to establish the system of checks and balances that we feel is necessary. And finally, I will be working with the President to seek an interim men's athletics director immediately and to conduct a search for a permanent director shortly thereafter. Next week, I will deliver our self-report to the NCAA. And while the completion of this investigation concludes the first stage in this process, the submission of the self-report will begin the NCAA review of this matter. We anticipate that the entire NCAA process, including a hearing before the Infractions Committee, will be completed by the early fall of 2000, and that the university will receive final findings and any additional sanctions around this time next year. In closing, I want to express my gratitude to the coaches, athletic department staff, and student athletes who have weathered this very difficult time and who have continued to perform in ways that make the university proud. I am honored to be joining them in moving forward as we work through the process of healing and rebuilding. Thank you.
As I'm working at WCCO-TV, in the early days after news of these allegations first broke, you spoke out on behalf of Clem Haskins. I would like to ask you if you now regret that and what your feelings are about this report's conclusions about Coach Haskins' actions as head of the basketball program.
Well, I guess the honest answer is if I knew then what I know now, I certainly would regret having spoken out in support of him at that time. At that time, I took him at his word. Investigators said that they didn't have any direct corroboration that he had known of these incidents, and I operated on that basis. I thought we needed new leadership. So I think I did make a mistake, but I didn't have all the information back then that I have today. It was just too early in the investigation to reach a conclusion as to his involvement.
Wasn't there some way, however, to indemnify the university against this kind of embarrassment? You say you did the right thing at the time, but in your statement you just identified Coach Haskins as interfering with the investigation.
Well, we'll look at those issues, but let me say two things. I think you've learned this. You know, one is you can only make the decision at the time when the information you had, and they said they didn't see any prospects that we would develop harder information. But, you know, I think we've had some recent experiences with this. We have an investigative report, and there's a long way between an investigative report and a jury finding when the witnesses are subject to credibility judgments and to cross-examination. And we would have had the burden of proof under a contract that would make it very difficult to
a provision or a clause that subsequently
he wouldn't sign it, and therefore
that you had interfered with the investigation, you would forfeit some of the settlement.
Well, that's a wonderful clause, and if I could have gotten it in, I would have.
Is there any way to pursue that now? Can you take him back to court? Do you plan to?
Well, we're looking at that, and I really don't want to get into that today. But it was so important to me. I just be honest, I didn't want the team going to Europe with the same people in charge. I didn't want them recruiting students. And we didn't get word until late October that we really had what the investigators concluded was sufficient evidence. I didn't want to go through that whole program with the same leadership intact. I thought there was a continuing black eye to the university. And if I could have gotten it done without a release clause, boy, I would have hopped right on that sucker. But it just wasn't possible. It was more important to me to get him out right away.
Mark, what sort of person, do you have somebody in mind for your interim? What sort of person are you looking for? For your permanent AD and the assist bolt prospect, is there a chance of a merger?
Well, at the moment, we're not looking at any sort of merger. And Chris Volz is not a candidate to be the men's athletic director. I don't I haven't really come around to thinking through, I guess, the permanent person. I want someone in the interim, obviously, is high integrity and has the trust of the coaches and some knowledge of our operations. For the long run, we want someone who will fit the profile that I describe, to be proactive, to look for the wrongdoing, to challenge what people at the next level of investigation put forward. I just think this sort of compartmentalization of responsibility, where you have a total lack of institutional compliance, but somehow no one is at fault, is just not acceptable. So it will involve a search to find people with other qualifications in that one.
Could you clarify Vice President Boston's position? Is he, as of now, no longer Vice President?
He will remain as Vice President until June 30th, 2000. I'm not Y2K adaptable.
Of
student development only. In other words, December 1st, the athletics component gets pulled out of that unit, and he would be on the payroll to June 30th, 2000, but only responsible for student development, which, you know, includes things like housing and food service and so forth.
Did you consider immediate termination of McKinley Boston and Martin Hart?
I thought that was disproportional. Despite some of the messages that people received, these people are not criminals. They're not felons. What they did was they managed some situations poorly. And I thought the humane, humanitarian thing to do for two decent individuals was to allow them to continue to the end of the year. In fact, they're not even being fired. The notion was that they would just simply not, their contracts would not be renewed. Mr. Dienhart chose an earlier termination date, which is his choice. Dr. Boston chose to go on to the end of the year. But, you know, you have to look at, so you don't look at just the volume of the corruption. You have to look to what was it that these folks did wrong. And my conclusion was they'd done a lot wrong, but they were managerial problems and not problems of corruption, and that the humane, honest thing to do was to allow them to continue to the end of their appointments of their contracts and to pursue other employment opportunities.
President, you know, on the issue of the faculty members that are brought up in the report, will they be disciplined in any way?
There, I guess I should start by saying I think there are five that are in the report. So that's, you know, when you have a faculty of thousands, it's not an epidemic. But yes, they will. The way that works is that we have established procedures through the colleges where faculty can be disciplined. So what we'll do is refer those cases to the colleges. You know, there are some of these cases involve intimidation. I think one involves just a grade, I'm not sure. But anyhow, yes, they will be disciplined. In fact, the Faculty Consultative Committee voted to censure such people, but we need to have a due process type of thing. You can't just take an investigative report and impose the sanction.
Does that mean dismissal, possibly?
It would depend on the circumstances. I honestly don't know the answer. It would depend on how often occurred and how corrupt the decision was.
Will Dr. Boston's salary change?
I don't think so. I think it will remain the same for this year. I have not cut his salary.
Will the new system of institutional oversight include more authoritative faculty oversight?
Well, we're working on that because I don't want to do something in haste that we don't get right. But the Faculty Consultative Committee, I think, it has done a very good job. They've recommended a system where the faculty would actually review transcripts, looking for patterns where students aren't graduating, they're just remaining eligible, and there'd be one group of faculty doing that and then another group on the policy side. Most of the recommendations on sort of sorting things out, you know, reporting of academic counseling come from the Clayton Committee report, which is an outstanding report, and we're going to embrace most, if not all, of that.
President, what kind of guarantee is there that we won't have another power coach phenomenon? After all, it seems to be a failing of people, not only a structure. You've made lots of structural changes, but what guarantee do we have that the new people involved won't allow a power coach?
You have no guarantees. You know, there are teapot domes, there's a Rand gate, there's Watergate. You have no guarantees. What you do is you move out the people who did it wrong. You do the best job you can selecting new people. You put in place a different structure. And frankly, you don't let it erode over time. At least while I'm here, we're not going to have any power coaches. We may have successful coaches, but we're not going to have power coaches. And but you know, I have to be honest. I mean, this is a national problem. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you it's impossible that it will ever occur at the University of Minnesota. I can't say that.
Aren't you sending mixed messages then again about Boston and Dean Hart? On the one hand, you praise their honesty and integrity. Then on the other hand, you say they should have known that there were several points along the way that they could have said, hey, something is really fishy here.
I don't consider that, unless you see no difference between culpability for the incident itself and mismanagement. Most, I think the legal structure is devoted to that distinction, and they were mismanagers.
How closely did you follow the recommendations of the Kansas law firm that you worked with?
Right down the line. I mean, you'll see when you read this report, which will take you a while, that they didn't say remove this person or transfer this person. But what they did was do a very thorough factual analysis to identify, you know, what happened in each incident and to do some analysis of that. But I can't think of any way we deviated from it. I mean, we got independent investigators. We did that for a reason. They came up with some very tough conclusions, and we went right down the line with them.
Are you angry at Coach Haskins? Have you contacted him? Have you expressed your outrage?
I have not contacted him. I am angry. I feel I was lied to my face, and that the problem was much deeper, and that this program was corrupt in almost any way one can think about it.
The men's athletic budget has been capped. Will they be allowed to use some of their surplus to pay these extraordinary expenses, or will it have to come out of the regular budget?
I haven't made that determination. If they have a surplus, I'd certainly have my eye on that. I just don't know the answer to your question. I mean, we need to generate funds to support the operations, and I don't want to jeopardize the operations of the men's athletic program. We've talked about, and we may have already done it for all I know, a sort of internal loan from our reserves where they would pay it back over time and therefore wouldn't have to reduce the scope of operations in the near future.
The investigative report outlines very closely several instances where members of the men's faculty department visited faculty members who had given grades they felt were incorrect, to put it mildly, and pressured faculty members to change those grades. The report also indicates places where the faculty members paid to that pressure or went to their superiors, who in turn said, go ahead and do it. Do you see any way to protect faculty members from that kind of intimidation in the future? And two, do you see any way that faculty members and their superiors who had them paid for this kind of pressure should have those issues addressed?
Well, I was as outraged by that by anything in the report. I mean, one group visits a faculty member and says, would you grade the student athlete's paper while we watch you? Now, there's an open invitation. I was deeply outraged by that. And I think what we're going to have is, at the rule level, and I think this gets back to, we're going to have a rule that says we don't want to cut off contact between the athletic program and the faculty, but we're sure not going to have a couple of coaches and a player all show up. We'll do it through the academic counseling program or through some prearranged sort of thing where you get approval to meet with the professor. So we'll adopt the rules, and then we'll try to create a climate that the first time that happens, the faculty calls 911 UDOF, and we'll put a stop to it. Now, we have to continue to be watchful about it, but the best we can do is tell faculty we encourage them to call Tanya Brown, preferably, actually, and put the rules in place. You know, and an interesting thing here is most of the coaches seem to understand. In fact, I think in every sport except basketball, you're not supposed to go in to see the professor. This was the only program where we have evidence. And again, we looked at all the programs. I don't think there's a single instance where a coach went in and tried to get a grade changed or whatever from another sport, only in basketball.
Are these fines severe enough to warrant the death penalty for the program?
I don't think so. I think it warrants probation and straightening, giving us a chance to straightening things out. I mean, these are very serious, but, you know, we have. I think we should be given a chance to correct them.
What about the violations in hockey and football? Will they be affecting the current players who will be reported?
You know, I don't really remember it, but there only were five or six secondary violations. We'll pursue all the violations, but there were only five or six. You have to remember, going from 1992 through 1998 or something like that, and so if you find five or six violations, and they're all secondary, I mean, it's important, but, you know, it's not going to be a set of big issues. We'll just refer them to the NCAA.
Can you give us your feelings on the findings related to Alonzo Newby, given the fact that he never did come forward? How do you feel about what the investigators found and his role in that?
Well, his role was pernicious. I mean, you name it, he did it. Whether it involved money or whether it involved duping registrars into changing grades, whether it involved visiting professors, whether it involved getting examinations postponed till after the exam, I got the feeling this is a man who must really have lived on the edge to try to keep all these players simultaneously eligible with all this sort of Mickey Mouse to get it done. So almost nothing would surprise me. And, of course, we drew the inferences, you know, sort of the what Newby would have said against him, you know, because he wouldn't come forward. And as you know, I've continued to exist, despite the good legal advice I get from political cartoonists, that I'm not into compensating witnesses. I am into honoring contracts. I'm into paying them their severance pay. But I'm not into witnesses. I think it would not surprise me, but that there are other activities of which we are unaware that Mr. Newby engaged in.
President Yudof, what about Elaine Donoghue, and what about Jan Gagelhoff?
Well, we don't really have jurisdiction over these people as a university anymore. I mean, they're not on our payroll. And
so,
you know,
how do you feel about them?
Oh, how do I feel about them?
Well,
you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, it's so conflicted. Elaine Donoghue really has the guts to go into the provost around 1992 and say, I think there's something wrong in the program. If for whatever reason, nothing happens at that point. And for a while, she sort of makes up her mind that she's just not going to get very involved in these issues. So you got this whole cluster of people gathering around this Gagelhoff's computer. She's not supposed to be tutoring any athletes, but they are athletes, and they're right outside Elaine's office, and she doesn't report any of this. She's sort of angry at the institution, I think, for not being receptive. And then later on, she gets back into it, and before she resigns, she really makes a powerful statement about there being a likelihood of corruption in the program. So to me, she's something of an enigma. She was very strong at some points, and at other points sort of threw in the towel. And no doubt, she was a difficult person to get along with, or at least these people felt that she was difficult. The personality interface was not good. Ms. Gagelhoff is also strange in the sense that she lied to the investigators time after time after time, not to our investigators, but to the investigations of violations at the time. She wasn't asked to do the work, but, you know, our conclusion is a lot of people knew about that, or at least Coach Haskins knew she was doing the work for the students. Then she did have the courage to come forward. That I admire, that she came forward and made her allegations. I've said I wish she came to me instead of to the media, but that's fine. She got the allegations out there. But she is an enigma because, you know, she led the cheating by a wide margin, and basically her claim is someone should have stopped me.
What about Coach Bates and his status? Because he has set up a couple of trial rooms now that he would resign if Dean Hart resigned. Have you had conversations with him? What do you think about those trial balloons?
I don't think he sent up those trial balloons. I've talked to Coach Mason three times in the last week and a half. I think he was a supporter of Mr. Dean Hart. He made no bones about it. I said, Coach, that's fine. And beyond that, I think you'd have to talk to him. My personal impression asking him is he's anxious about the leadership of the athletic department, but he has said to me that he would assess who the new leaders were. That's the last word that I got from him. Well, you know, this is a wide misconception. You know, I didn't make up the rules here. Now everyone from the assistant coach on up to the vice president is gone, including the tutors and everything. We have taken the other organizational actions that we described today. The NCAA imposes penalties on teams. It wasn't my decision, wasn't my idea. They impose penalties on teams. So if you think that's unjustified, or I think it's unjustified, it really doesn't matter a whole lot because they have the rule book. What I did was, I think, primarily to say we're going to come forward with some early sanctions on the team, on the innocent, if you will, because I think if we don't do that and show good faith, they will impose worse sanctions, which they may do anyhow.
Mr. Dienhardt said today he had, in effect, limited control over Clem Haskins. Do you believe that to be the case? And in a perfect world, what should he have done when the coaches repeatedly denied any wrongdoing as well as tutors?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, it was not easy for Mr. Dienhardt. And he didn't have control over Coach Haskins. I think that's right. But we felt there were opportunities along the way. Those investigations could have been conducted in an above-board way, at least some of them. There were opportunities, as Ms. Donahue found an opportunity, to bring those matters up the line. Just suspicions, not knowledge of the treating, but just suspicions. I think he was in a tough situation. I think he didn't have complete control. I know that he was not too enthused about Mr. Newby. I know that he really... in the Courtney James matter, really stepped up front to deal with that situation in the day in a way that was disagreeable to Mr. Haskins. He did come forward on a number of occasions. But when we looked at the pattern, it was just, we felt that there were warning signs which could have been picked up on, which admittedly would have been tough, but there were opportunities to do it and it should have been done.
President Gudoff, you said you have not talked to Coach Haskins. Do you plan to talk to him, and do you know where he is?
I have no present plans to talk to him. I don't know where he is.
President Gudoff, what course of action will the university take against individuals who are directly involved in misconduct but who are currently not in the university?
Actually, we're going to take a look at that. That turns out to be a complicated question, and we're going to put someone in the provost office in charge. If you're talking about students, it may mean changing grades, providing failing grades or whatever other penalty if they're already outside of the institution. I don't know what we'll do if degrees have been granted. There weren't very many degrees granted during this period.
One.
You know, with respect to... individuals, I'll have to think about it, but I don't feel vindictive, and I don't know that I feel like, and I don't know that there'd be any legal action that would make any sense at all against some of the employees who, you know, are not here, can't, by definition, can't be fired, their pay can't be altered or anything. So I think that would be up to civil or criminal authorities, and I don't think there's much in the way of criminal here.
What's your opinion of those who say that you cleaned house today to fire three white men when the other people have been fired before have been?
Well, I'll tell you what I have to say about that. A couple things. There was a debate within the administration, indeed a very healthy debate on the board. You know, what's the standard you apply? You know, it was it sufficient that you headed up the operation when all these things went south? Did you have to be directly, you know, a part of it? You know, you sort of, you were one of the people who walked into the office to intimidate a professor or something in between. And being a law professor, I decided I would do the complicity plus test, and that was that not that you had to be complicit, but was there knowledge that came to you which you reasonably could have used to take some action during that period of time. And that was sort of the test I used. And I applied that across the board. I don't care if you're white or you're black or you're green. That was the same standard that was applied to everyone. And that's what I did. You know, my position, I'm very much pro diversity. I'm pro affirmative action. You all know that. I've defended those policies. I frankly, you know, I'm uncomfortable that so many African Americans were involved in these disciplinary actions, but there's no license either way. You won't be penalized because of your color, and you won't be advantaged. We're going to apply the same standard.
President, you know, you have recommended changes in how sexual assault is handled, and a separate committee has also. Mac Boston has had oversight over that as supervisor. Did you consider that when you, as you have kept him on for the next 6 months until the contract is
signed? I'm going to have to look at that. Chris, I think that's, you know, that's a good point. That's what I said. There'd have to be some more sorting. I want to make sure about conflicts of interest, and I will look at that. That center, of course, is primarily advisory. You know, I mean, they're what do I want to say? It's like a clinical role where they counsel victims and so forth. They don't actually bring charges and stuff like that. But I certainly will look at that.
When do you look at it? What
do you mean by your question?
I asked if you considered that when you decided.
No, I haven't considered it to now, but. I have no evidence that he was acted improperly in supervising that unit. Is that your question?
In supervising a number of programs that handle sexual assault.
No. I'm unsure where you're going. There is a sexual violence center, which is sort of, as I say, clinically oriented, deals with complaints. The Equal Opportunity Office will deal with what used to be done. You know, if someone says I was sexually harassed, they will go to the Equal Opportunity Office in Julie Schweitzer. We moved that out earlier, and we're going to leave it out. So the only thing that, to my knowledge, but I'll double check, is the center itself, which provides sort of human services. But all the complaints, decisions, processing of complaints will be in the Equal Opportunity Office.
President Udall, aside from the postseason ban that you have put forth on the basketball team, what other sanctions and penalties can these guys expect?
Well, I don't know. You know, this is a very serious. We were voted the fourth greatest crime in NCAA history of the 20th century or something. I think it's a very serious matter, and it doesn't help to speculate, but you know, you can have longer probation, you can have longer ineligibility for postseason play, you can have scholarships, you can have limitations on the number of scholarships, limitations on the number of visits to campus, all the way up to the death penalty, which I believe is illegal in Minnesota anyhow.
You said that there will be no more power coaches while you're here. I wonder what your thoughts are on the influence of powerful outsiders, such as the governor and other interests who kind of brought their interest in the athletic department to play in the past, and how do you prevent that from happening?
Well, I think that's extremely difficult. I'm not going to comment on Governor Carlson, but you know, there are these shifting winds. You know, the idea is that many people in this state, including those in powerful positions, thought Coach Haskins was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And our people weren't duped by the contract. They thought, you know, this is a guy you got to keep. And then in the younger generation of sports writers, not you, Charlie, you're too old, comes by and says, you know, why? How could you do that? So I think that is a problem, and I think it's tough. I think I hope there's times when you're just going to have to stand up and say, you're a great coach, we want to keep you, we're not getting a 10-year contract.
Yeah.
And thank you very much.
Chris, you know, how much money do you have to give back to the NCAA?
Mark.